You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, June 25th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And joining us all the way from Australia is Joe Benamou. Joe, welcome to the SGU.
Hi, Steve. Hi, everyone.
Joe.
Hey, Joe.
How are
ya? I'm good. How are you all?
Good. Even though we're talking to you over Skype, you're a lot closer than you usually are. You're on the East Coast of the U.S. visiting.
That's correct. I'm visiting the States for a couple of weeks, having a bit of a holiday.
So what have you done?
Well, it's a bit of a family holiday. I've been up to Baltimore, spent a bit of time up there, taken a lot of Amtraks, and enjoyed the lovely summer weather, which is a nice change from Melbourne, which right about now is freezing cold. And just hanging out, really.
So, Joe, give us an update on what skeptical shenanigans are going on down under.
As the listeners probably know from Richard Saunders giving you fairly regular updates, I think things are usually pretty busy down under. The main thing is dealing with the anti-vax community in Australia, which has been a project which has been carried out by a combination of both the Australian Skeptics, Friends of Science in Medicine, and the Stop the AVN for years now. You know, we've been dealing with anti-vaxxers in Australia for decades, much like everyone has, really. I mean, you know, they've been around since vaccination's been around.
Really? Even way back then when it was, I would say, more obvious?
Have you ever seen the cartoon? There's like the cartoons where they, you know, they were saying that people who had smallpox vaccinations, if I remember correctly, because they used the cowpox. But essentially, there's those caricatures of those cartoons showing people turning into cows from having the vaccine.
Oh.
Anti-vaxxers have been around since vaccines were invented. They don't go away, but I have to say we're doing a really good job in Australia of dealing with them, and Stop the AVN's really been the main force behind that. You know, we started about 8 years ago now. Sadly, the catalyst for us starting was the death of a little girl by the name of Dana McCaffrey, who caught whooping cough at the age of 4 months. She was too young to be vaccinated, and you know, her parents, Tony and David, lost her, and unfortunately became the target of the anti-vaccination community merely for just the fact that her death was in the media. Meryl Dorey and the group that were then known as the AVN, the Australian Vaccination Network, leapt onto Dana's death and started targeting the family and claiming that she hadn't really died of whooping cough. And really engaging in, you know, some pretty horrific, horrific techniques to kind of question what had happened, question whether she had the diagnosis, and, you know, started doing what a lot of anti-vaxxers do to grieving parents who've had, children die of vaccine preventable illnesses, which is to start targeting them and harassing them and so on. And, at the time, you know, a number of people, including some from the Australian Skeptics, were absolutely outraged at what this family was experiencing. And, the group Stop the AVN was formed as a result. And essentially for the last 8 years, we've just been plugging away and, you know, just finding every possible avenue we can to get rid of, anti-vaxxers in Australia. You know, it's not like it's something that we just sort of snapped our fingers and got rid of them. It's been a lot of hard work, a lot of dedicated people really just, you know, trying to deal with this issue because they felt passionate about it.
I mean, fanaticism really turns people into horrible human beings, you know?
It does. It does.
Because you can justify a lot of nonsense.
Absolutely. And look, I have to say there have been times when, I mean, certainly you look at what groups like the AVN have actually, you know, the techniques they use. You know, there was a recent case in the media where they were, and in fact, this is the kind of thing where the AVN always painted themselves as this very sort of, caring organization who cared about, you know, people, the welfare of children and so on. But when you looked at their techniques, you know, they often would show their true colors, and they got into a lot of trouble recently when, for the second time, they made a comparison between vaccination and rape, mm-hmm. and they used a horrible image of an assault, a woman being assaulted, and made the comparison between that and vaccination, and of course that outraged a lot of people in the community, and you know, they've really shown their true colors through a lot of that. But the thing is that even with Stop the AVN, you know, when we first started, we were a group of very angry people. But over time, as we've kind of grown, as we, you know, we're just a Facebook page. We're not an organization that has sort of a formal membership. But we've got a core group of people who've kind of been working at it all this time. But initially, you know, we were disorganized and we were angry and you know, we sort of had to, we were a diamond in the rough, so to speak. But we've had to become more organized and professional as we've realized who's actually listening to us, because we now have the attention of politicians and the media. You know, we've received praise within the Australian Senate and, had ministers, contact us, because they're now really aware of the importance of this issue, and we've become a highly effective lobby group. So, you know, through doing that, we've had to kind of give up some of the, I guess, the anger that drove the group initially, had to really recede a little bit to allow us to kind of find our focus and really gain a better understanding of how we could be more effective. You know, we've had to think really hard about things like our brand and what our position are on things. You know, we've gained the support of the media, the Australian Medical Association, a lot of academics and politicians. Our strategy really has been to challenge the AVN everywhere we can. We correct their misinformation on Facebook and, you know, elsewhere on the internet. We're constantly reporting them to government regulators, you know, as we call them, the acronyms, just generally trying to hold them hold them accountable for what they do. One of the terms that, you know, has come to be used is, and I think it was, Dr. Dave Hawkes who actually came up with it, is the concept of the professional anti-vaxxer, you know, the people who really, they make money off what they do. And it's kind of really important to separate out the difference between these people who are really quite calculating in their actions and often know that what they're doing is quite despicable, and then the vulnerable parents who are just frightened of hurting their children and who are susceptible to the misinformation that they're putting out there. You know, as a skeptic, you've got to, I think, learn to not belittle and shout down people who are questioning, but you've got to find a way to kind of keep that dialogue open so that you can help them come around. And with parents who are worried about their kids, that's something that is really hard to do, especially when they find themselves immersed in this culture, which is telling them that they're going to, you know, they're going to damage their children if they vaccinate. Mm-hmm. But in terms of our successes, we've had a huge effect in Australia. We've managed to see new legislation come in. So there's a recent policy called the No Jab, No Pay policy, which was brought in by the current government. In the past, something that really bothered us was the fact that in Australia, you could get an exemption from vaccinating your kids just by getting a doctor to sign a conscientious objector form. The problem with this was parents are able to get a tax bonus by being up to date with the immunization schedule. This loophole meant that if they got this conscientious objector form signed, they could still get that money without actually vaccinating their kids. And that's just outrageous. I mean, that's just basically you're failing in your social responsibility and you're getting a bonus for it. So the government has now stripped that from them. You know, we've been plugging away at this issue for 8 years now, and it's become, through a lot of what SAVN have done, it's become socially unacceptable to hold anti-vax views in Australia. Looking at the landscape in America, you know, I know you guys have got quite a different landscape to deal with in terms of the number of states you've got, the number of people, and various issues around how you deal with the anti-vax community. Yeah. And I know that the groups here are quite different in how they operate.
Yeah, although I do think that we are turning a corner, and it is also becoming, as you say, like sort of politically unacceptable to be anti-vaccine. They have been marginalized a lot, although they have their subcultures. You know, there are little pockets where anti-vaccine views are still entrenched.
And that I that would congregate around similar communities where there are, you know, a certain ideological sort of heartland where they all sort of congregate. But I mean, you had to have a measles outbreak for that to sort of become part of the conversation again. And in fact, interestingly, that outbreak happened around the same time that we had Sherry Tenpenny coming to Australia. And, you know, that was a perfect example of how, you know, just really being, the way we've really been able to challenge, the anti-vaccination crowd is by getting to know them inside out. You know, we know who the people are. We understand how they work. We understand their language and we're sort of almost there all the time to kind of challenge them wherever they turn up.
To get back to something you said previously, I do think that you have to walk a fine line. You do need passion, and sometimes that means anger. You got to be angry at the world, you know, to really have the persistent motivation to put in the years of work trying to change things. But you really have to be careful about coming off as passionate in your activism, because that will be so quickly turned against you. You'll be made to seem like you're the fanatic when you're just defending science and reason. Somehow you're now the fanatic because you show some passion. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I always, Carol Tavris has made such an impression on me in, you know, the years that I've been involved with skepticism. And, you know, she wrote the book Anger, the Misunderstood Emotion. And I remember actually, speaking to her and, you know, she talked about the fact that, you know, anger is so important for starting a movement, for getting that fire going, but it can't sustain it. This was what got us fired up in the first place. But we very quickly were accused by a lot of people of being fanatics, of being extremists. And it's something that we experience in Friends of Science in Medicine. It's very easy, like even for example, with chiropractors, you know, you've got the straights and the mixers in chiropractic, the ones who believe in subluxation and so on. And then you've got the chiropractors who are essentially are practicing a musculoskeletal therapy and who are much really should be physical therapists. And you kind of have to make a decision of, you know, do you completely alienate all of them, or do you find a middle ground where you can work with the chiropractors who are more open, who are going to, for example, on the issue of vaccination, who are going to be advocates for vaccination, who aren't anti-science? You've got to kind of not just write everyone off, and you've got to find that kind of that ability to say, look, you know, we can work together on this and we can find kind of some common ground, and picking your battles as well. And certainly with, you know, with the vaccination issue, it's just really, really hard to make sure that you don't alienate people and come off as just sort of angry, raging activists.
No, yeah, but I think you guys are clearly doing a great job. You know, you've accomplished quite a bit. You know, one of the real success stories, I think, in skeptical activism.
And look, it's something we're really proud of. And, you know, everything from the changes to legislation to things like having publications in peer review journals. We've got a paper on HPV by a number of, because we've got a lot of academics involved, and we've had a couple of, we've had a systematic review published and a couple of other papers. We've been invited to attend national vaccination advocacy symposiums, and we've had posters at conferences. And, you know, it's kind of, we've become a group that people take seriously, and it's no longer, while we are just that group on the internet, on Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, there are people out there who are working really hard who have developed it into something that is really effective.
Well, keep up the good work.
Yeah.
You guys.
We will. Please. We will. We don't stop. There's not a minute where we're not thinking about it and working on it. So we hope that we can set a bit of an example for other groups.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Bob, we're going to get started with the regular show. You have a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Maria Gebhardt Mayer, who was an influential physicist and the first woman to win a Nobel Prize for theoretical physics, and the second woman to win at all after Curie, of course. And she did this for her work on nuclear shell structure. Now, Gebhardt Mayer was born in 1906 and died in 1972. She was interested in science and math and growing up early in her career. And she ran into a lot of the typical roadblocks that a lot of women of that era did. At that point in history, schools just flat out would not teach her, because of her gender. And, some of the early science jobs that she did get were often for no pay at all. Yet still, she did leave quite a mark in that field. Her career in pure mathematics kind of ended voluntarily when she plugged herself into the quantum mathematical community in Europe. She was exposed to two greats like Niels Bohr and Max Born, and she just fell in love with that community so much and what it was all about that she actually switched her career to physics. Now, she did, there are a few high points to her career that are interesting. She wrote a landmark paper on double beta decay, and she also worked for the Manhattan Project, working in the top secret Los Alamos Laboratory in New Mexico. But the one place where I think she really left her mark was in nuclear shell theory. This theory is a model for how the nuclei of atoms work in terms of their structure and their energy levels. And one of the major mysteries they had to solve at that time was this idea of magic numbers. Now, these magic numbers are the numbers themselves are 2, 8, 20, 28, 50, 82, and 126. These numbers correspond to the numbers of protons or neutrons in an atomic nucleus. So if you had, say, 20 protons in that atom, it would be very, very stable. And that what that stability actually means, though, is that you would have to pump in a lot more energy into that nucleus to actually dislodge anything. So that's what they kind of meant by stability. And if you had, say, the protons and the neutrons, each of them having the magic number, say 20 protons and 20 neutrons, then it's called double magic because you would be exceedingly stable. So what she did to resolve that is she basically mathematically described this model in such a way that it became more clear what those magic numbers mean and other characteristics of the nuclei themselves. So it was incredibly a successful model. And for that, she won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1963, along with J. Hans D. Jensen, who came up with a very similar treatment right around the same time, and also Eugene Wigner, who's a very famous physicist. They all contributed, and they all won the prize. So remember Maria Gebhardt-Meyer? Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing three-dimensional harmonic oscillators and spin-orbit interactions.
But not two-dimensional ones. Don't mention it then.
Don't even go there.
Bob, what were the magic numbers again?
2, 28, 20, 28, 50, 82, and 126. No, they are not. They are not the lost numbers, if that's what you were thinking.
Because that corresponds to, like, 20 is calcium, 28 is nickel. So that means that those are especially stable elements?
Sure.
All right, Jay, you were going to tell us about a new bionic lens.
All right, so I thought that this was, if it's true, this is a pretty damn amazing thing, a pretty awesome advancement in technology that we're all going to benefit from. So I'm going to go through this thing, and then you guys can let me know what you think. I had a few red flags go up when I was reading about it. It sounds awfully promising, but it could be true. So let's take a deeper dive into this. So there's an optometrist in British Columbia named Garth Webb, and he has developed a bionic lens that he says will give patients perfect vision. So Webb has been in development on this project for the past 8 years, and he's only spent $3 million on this project, which I thought was a little, not that much if you think about it. I mean, it's, you know, $3 million for this kind of research that doesn't seem like a lot of money. But I don't know. You never know, you know, why the dollars weren't above that, but that's what he spent. He calls it the Ocumetrics Bionic Lens. And those of you who get it, Evan, I'm sure you're going to run out and get this. You'll never need glasses or contact lenses again.
Where are my glasses?
Well, Jay. Now, Jay, what do you mean by, you said perfect vision? What does that actually translate to? What does that mean?
They're claiming that this will give you three times the quality of 20/20 vision. So how would you translate that, Bob?
I would translate that as bullshit.
Well, yeah, but if that were the case, that would be the equivalent of, instead of 20/20 vision, you would have 26.6. And that means that what the average person with 20/20 vision could see at 6.5 feet, you could see it at 20 feet. So that's dramatic. Whoa. That's actually so dramatic that it exceeds what's possible with normal human eyes. Cause I think 28 is like the biological limit of what people can see. If you have the best vision, it's 28. So if this is actually 26.6, then that is truly remarkable. And I guess you could call it bionic because it's really augmenting what's possible. Yeah. So that's cool if it's true.
Which it probably isn't.
They also said that this bionic lens actually replaces your eyes' existing lenses. So this eliminates cataracts or the possibility of getting cataracts because a cataract is the blurring of that lens that you have. That it's supposed to be clear, but as you get older and for certain reasons, that lens can turn cloudy. This, of course, you know, they whip out that lens, they put in the bionic lens, and you have perfect vision again. So anybody can get these, regardless of age, except that Dr. Webb recommends that people don't get them until they're 25, because that's when your eyes are supposed to be fully developed. Each lens has to be custom made for each of the patient's eyes, right? Hmm. They insert them into your eye folded over, mm-hmm. like, so it's kind of like a taco shape. They make a sub 2.7 millimeter incision with the aid of a femtosecond laser. So, you know, then it gets in your eye and 10 seconds after they put it in there, it opens itself up and flattens out, right? So if you're a little bit queasy, you might not want to hear this next thing, but they use this syringe to stick in your eye and they squirt it in there. It's pretty nasty. The entire procedure takes only 8 minutes, Evan. What the hell? That's pretty fast for, you know, them cutting my eye open and swapping out my lens.
It's like cooking with a microwave. I like it.
Jay, just so you know, a femtosecond is pretty damn fast. We're talking 1/4 of a second or 1/1,000,000 of a billionth. So yeah, that's very fast, but not the fastest. I think they actually have attosecond.
Well, I'll tell you, Bob, if I'm getting like my driver's license renewed and I'm on that line, I get bored in a femtosecond. I hate being there. All right. So this bionic eye is made of a biocompatible polymetric material, which I think sounds awesome. But I guess what that means is your body won't reject it. It has camera-like optics, and it can shift focus from optical infinity, which is cool sounding, to a very close range more rapidly than the perceptual limits of the human brain, according to the company. That was a very impressive statement.
That's, I think, one of the cruxes of this new technology, I think, because if they're just slipping this into the eye, without any mention of actually, you know, attaching it to muscles and things, I just don't know how it could possibly know that it needs to focus and it would actually achieve any focus. So without that question being answered, it just, you know, raises my skeptical alarms even more. But I mean, that's just my thought.
That's the actual only new bit here. I mean, taking out a lens and putting in a fake lens is old news. You know, that's how you treat cataracts now.
I agree, Steve, but from what Jay is saying, it seems like the optical clarity is probably better with this than those as
Why?
Well.
So,
well, I mean, because even if you put in a replacement lens, a non-bionic replacement lens, I mean, I don't think so we talked about this earlier. We said that you could probably focus at a distance very well, but then you would need glasses for close up because it doesn't focus. Yeah. But even with your long distance vision, I don't think it would be the equivalent of 20/26 vision. I think it would be good.
So first of all, the 26.6 vision, that to me just sounds like complete bullshit. I have no idea how a lens will even do that. The only thing a lens can do is correct refractive problems. And the lens problems, you know, but it'll treat or prevent cataracts, fine. But other than that, the best it could do is give you perfect refractive vision. Why would that give you better than 20/20 vision? There's no explanation for that.
Well, what about the quality of the image that's focused on your fovea? I mean, can't there be a range of quality?
But why would that be better than a young, healthy lens?
Biological lenses are not perfect optical devices. They've got, you know, imperfections and things with them that are just because they're biological. They're not.
Yeah, I don't buy it. They give no explanation of why that would be. There's no details. There's absolutely no explanation on the company's website, on anything that's published. There's nothing published in the scientific literature about this at all. We're basically getting a promotional press release from a company who is still in development, or they have it, but it hasn't been tested on people that need to do clinical trials. So what are they basing these claims on? It's wishful thinking and marketing. But the big thing is they give absolutely zero indication of what the technology actually is. How is it possible that this lens can change its focus? Now, there are three different types of lenses you could put into an eye, you know, in cataract surgery. One basically is just a fixed monofocal lens. It focuses essentially in the distance and then you wear reading glasses. You could have what are essentially multifocal lenses, like bifocal glasses. That could focus far and close up. But, you know, they're not perfect and people will often need to wear corrective lenses in any case. And then there are lenses that can correct for things like astigmatism. That's it. There's no such thing as a lens that could change its focus. So if that's what he's claiming, then that's huge. That is a completely new technology. And he's just asserting it. He's just saying, I have a lens that can do this without giving even the slightest explanation for how the technology actually works. And it doesn't seem possible that such a simple operation, 8 minutes, you just squirt it into the eye, it unfolds and takes up shop. It just sort of fits in the cavity where the lens fits. That's standard. But okay, and then what? How is this little piece of lens that folds up and can unfold, how does that change its focus? I mean, you know, I can't imagine how it would work, and the company gives us no indication how it does work. You know, they might as well have said it's magic. Not holding my breath.
I'm not either, but you know, because it does sound like it's so good. Everything about it is so epically awesome that, you know, I very rarely combine those two words, but they are really making phenomenal claims here.
I suppose given that it's such a seemingly such a leap ahead from existing technology, it's strange that there's so little on the,
There's
actually
no paper
is.
Trail. There's no research trail. This guy doesn't have much of a trail himself, other than that he runs an optometry clinic in Canada and he's got some patents to his name. But nothing. There's no trail leading up to this. And again, like if they said, this is the technology. This is the new bit. This is how we did it without giving away trade secrets. Some indication of what kind of technology we're talking about, but we don't even have that. I see no reason to take this seriously.
They said that they are going to be running clinical trials soon, and that Canada and Europe is about 2 years away from it being used, and the U.S. FDA clearance is 3 years after that, and the early estimates are that it would be about $3,200 per eye.
That's a wild boast, yeah. I think. Clinical trials and
The clinical trials go well, it's a huge if. That's just saying if I win a lottery, and I think that price, Jay, is like not including the surgery. That's just like the price.
Yeah, I was gonna say
materials. Oh. Materials cost.
Yeah.
And I gotta ask the doctor a question because I want to know if I can actually zoom in on stuff with this. Could you imagine?
Well, I mean, if the wild ass claims are true, this is a actual bionic lens that could focus, that could magnify, then there's no limit. Then, except for how much you could miniaturize it, sure, you could theoretically get zoom in vision.
Yeah. Okay. Go for broke at this point. But like you said, we've got nothing.
Yeah.
Right
we
now.
Just have an extraordinary claim in a corporate press release looking for investors and saying that they plan on doing clinical trials. This is worth almost nothing.
It's undoubtedly dubious, but I hope it's true.
I hope that EM drive works too. I hope that every free energy claim is true, but none of them are true. I'm not holding my breath. This is not a free energy claim, but it's like almost, you know, it's not impossible, but it's like claiming such a leap forward in technology with nothing to even hang your hat on. It might as well be. All right, let's move on. We're going to do a sort of movie review. I saw the movie Inside Out, Pixar's new movie for the summer. This is a very cute story, like all of Pixar's movies. I highly recommend it. I very much enjoyed it. Basically, it's a story of an 11-year-old girl who's going through some stuff in her life. But the new bit, the clever bit with the movie, is that you get to peek inside her head and see the inner functionings of her mind. Of course, played out through cute, cartoony metaphors, right? But what I found was interesting was the thought experiment of if you wanted to create a metaphor for the inner workings of the brain and you wanted to make it really neuroscientifically accurate, how would you do it? So let me tell you what the Pixar writers did. So first of all, they did say that they did a lot of research and they tried to be as accurate as they could, although they made a lot of choices for the
drama and entertainment value and plot of the movie. You know, that the being a good movie came first and being accurate came second. And that's fine. And again, this is not criticism. I totally get that. This is not a neuroscience primer. It's a movie. Again, just as a jumping off point for a thought experiment about what kind of metaphor would you craft. So the main component of the inner workings of the brain that they were showing was the command center, right? Like the central command center of the brain, which is actually a pretty terrible metaphor because there is no such thing as a command center, really. There's no centralized location where memories get played back and where the control panel is. Consciousness is distributed. You know, it's more like a committee all over the brain, sort of all vying for attention. And there was they chose five primary emotions: joy, sadness, anger, fear, and disgust. They said while they were doing research for the movie, they talked to psychologists, to experts, and they got all kinds of different answers, everywhere from 3 to 27 in terms of how many emotions there are.
Wow, not much consensus there, is there?
Yeah. 27 different emotions, but then they whittled it down to 5, you know, just for simplicity, you know, just for the sake of the movie itself. But there were some, like surprise was one. And they said like surprise, yeah, any gag they would have for surprise, they could pretty much run off of fear. And so that's why they just sort of got rid of surprise, because it was dramatically redundant. You know, again, regardless of whether it was appropriate for the metaphor. So anyway, the different emotions, when the girl was happy, joy was at the controls, and then that would tinge the controls, you know, joyous. And when she was angry, anger was at the controls, you know. So that, I kind of like that metaphor where like different emotions will be dominant at different times, you know, thinking of the idea, like when you're like out of control with anger, like anger is at the controls of your brain. That's, I think that's fine. That's a fine metaphor. What was entirely missing, however, was executive function. So it's like half the brain was missing. So you had the deep primitive lizard brain emotions were there.
The limbic system.
But where was the frontal lobes? Where was the executive function, which should be at war, you know, essentially trying to control those more primitive impulses? I would have liked a metaphor where you had, if you're going to have like the limbic system where different emotions were at the controls, that would work. It wouldn't be the command center. That would be like, it would be a little bit deeper down. But then there should be executive control upstairs that actually had control over the emotions, although the emotions were rebellious, you know, and they would sometimes.
Right.
The executive function doesn't always control the emotions. And
they could have had a big hand come down and just like,
yeah,
like hold the emotions. Like, no, I'm in control right now. Sorry, I'm not going to listen to you.
Yeah, there's a lot of cute things they could have done with that if they wanted to go in that direction. I thought of, like, I would have loved. So if you think of executive function as like the king or queen, you know, up in the head office upstairs, and with the right, rebellious emotions downstairs, always trying to make trouble. And then the king has like a Grima worm tongue standing behind him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whispering in his ear. And that would be a metaphor for rationalization, right? So it's like, oh, anger wants to do this, but I know it's not the right thing to do. But then the Grima's like, yeah, but if we did, we could do this and this would be okay. And you know what I mean? Sort of rationalizing how to accommodate the planning part of your brain with the emotional part of your brain.
See, I just get the old guy, you know, with the broom and the noisy kids upstairs and him just banging on the ceiling and telling them to keep it down.
Yeah. So that was interesting. Some of the metaphor that they used for memories was okay, but they were essentially hard glass spheres, right? Each memory was a discrete glass sphere. That doesn't really represent memories. I mean, would have been much better if they were like soap bubbles or amorphous blobs that could merge
change
with each other and were morphing. And
yes.
Every time you know, tried to access a memory, you would change it and morph it. Yeah, that would have been memory should have been more fluid, not these discrete glass bulbs. And then not only were these solid, immobile things, but you can replay the memory in perfect fidelity over and over again, you know? So it was,
yeah,
completely the wrong. metaphor for memory.
I always think a lava lamp would be quite a nice one because you could have that thing, but it's constantly changing. It's the same structure, but it's constantly changing.
Yeah, I mean, they should be semi-stable, right? Not totally unstable, but they got to have the ability to morph and to merge and all that stuff that memories do.
That's just something that our culture in general has just not internalized yet.
Yeah.
The quality of, you know, memories of what they're really like and how malleable they are. We're just not there yet. People just, the average person just does not appreciate that fact.
Yeah, but we think we do. But we think we do. We think our memories are practically infallible.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the catch. Like videotapes stored away, just like those glass spheres. That's the conception of it. But that's how, as skeptics, we know that's.
It's one of those things that's incredible. Again, it's that the whole thing of challenging people's perceptions. I mean, you know, challenging people's memory is something that's incredibly difficult to do.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
which is why we live in, well, one of the advantages of living in the age we live in today is that so many things are recorded. And I think that helps overall. You know, you can go back and let's see the videotape and let's see what really happened. So I think that there's an advantage there.
It doesn't matter if it's recorded, you're still not going to convince them that that orb isn't an orb.
Steve, how do you think they settled on the emotions that they picked?
I think just for dramatic effect, you know, which, you know what I mean?
They
wanted ones that would be different enough, you know, that they wouldn't be dramatically redundant, but that would be basic emotions.
And that would lend themselves to a cute characterization, a cute character, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like disgust was fine, humor, but why disgust? I mean, I agree that that's actually a much overlooked emotion that's very important. I actually like that choice. But,
I mean, do each of the emotions have their own character arc? Because that's also what would feed into how they'd write, sort of decide, make those decisions around, you know, if you've got too many characters, it's a matter of how you actually get the story.
Oh, that's why they chose five. They were they were the five main characters of the show, were the five emotions. You know,
and do they interact, Steve?
Yeah. They were like people, yeah.
Hey, Joe, this was like the old television show from the 90s, Herman's Head.
I love that show. That's one of my favorite shows of all time. I love it.
Now, it was funny.
Steve, did they give any insight into other characters' heads in the movie?
Yeah, you would pop into other people's heads at different times in the movie. It was
their differences?
That's interesting. So how could you represent the differences among people by the different ways the inside of their heads looked? So like the control panels would be different, would be more elaborate for older people. In fact, like I love the fact that the infant's control panel was a single button. Right? So either joy was pushing the button or sadness was pushing the button. Another one, so each memory was tainted with the color of one emotion. So you had like angry memories and sad memories and happy memories. But then when she got older, you had memories that were combinations of emotions. Then she would have both an angry and happy memory at the same time.
Interesting.
So more emotionally complicated, which I get that. But I thought there should have been more emotions. They should have allowed more interaction. So the control panels got more sophisticated.
There's as many as 27 emotions.
Yes, that's right. The control panels got more sophisticated. The memories got more complex. And then the other main metaphor that they used, and this is really a major part of the movie, was they had core memories, which has no real analog in neuroscience. And the core memories established personality islands. Right. So like the main constructs of her personality, like her family or love for her family, was based upon a core memory of being with her mother and her father. So I thought that was totally contrived and not real. I mean, I think that's not a good metaphor for accuracy. Personality in the movie was based entirely on memory. So there was an implicit blank slate assumption in that metaphor.
So
in
other words,
that's not right.
You know, we're born completely blank, and then it's only our memories, our exposure to the environment that establishes our personality. And without those core memories, like the personality literally goes away. Whereas in reality, a lot of your personality is just genetic and hardwired. You know, it's just there.
Yeah.
Oh, so they start them with a blank slate, Steve?
Well, that's the implicit assumption. Yes.
The environment is everything.
Is everything, yeah.
Well, think about an animator's perspective on things. That is sort of how they approach all things. Everything is a blank slate, and then you start drawing.
But imagine this.
You start sculpting
How about this metaphor? That the personality could have been represented by something like the architecture of the structures inside the brain, and that fixed.
I like it.
So, yeah, the way the things were created, how neat and tidy it was, and how whatever. You could make the environment could be completely different and not completely immutable, but right. pretty hardwired in there. And, you know, it'll change only slowly. Not the kind of thing like, oh, that core memory's gone or tainted, so that changes your whole personality changes. No, that.
Right. So then if they showed a kid, the environment for a kid's mind could be a little bit more malleable and amorphous. But if it's an older person's mind, it's like stone. It's like, this is not going to change, right?
Right. So anyway, there's some other, lots of cute bits in there. You know, they certainly did not explore that metaphor for all it was worth, but because they didn't have time, you know. And I've read, you know, doing my research for this segment, that there was a ton of stuff. They wrote a ton of stuff that never made it into the movie. But I'll give you my favorite bit that they did keep. And at one point, there's a box of...
What's in the box?
Yeah, there's a box of these chits that are labeled opinions, and there's another box labeled facts. And they get spilled, and they get all mixed up.
Ah!
And one of the characters says, just put him back. That happens all the time.
Oh, my God. Great idea.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was cute.
Yay, Pixar. Another
It was
hit.
A great movie. Again, I recommend it. It was very cute, very fun. Again, do not email me and say, Steve, it was just a movie. I know that. I get it. You need to get it. I'm just using it as an excuse to talk about metaphors for how the brain works, how the mind works. And that's
fine.
It.
I'll delete the email.
Why do you care?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm typing it now.
Don't read the
Steve, you rat bastard.
You totally messed up.
You don't know
up.
What the hell you're talking about.
Don't read the Facebook comments when I posted about it.
Oh, no. Bad for your health.
Yeah.
All right, so
I read comments with one eye open.
Oh gosh.
All right, see go see this movie, yes or no?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Very, very cute.
I can't wait. It's Pixar. You really don't need any other reason.
All right, Evan, I understand there are pyramids on Mars and the largest asteroid series.
That is correct, and they both made the news this past week. Well, let's start with Mars. So I read about this in the Mirror, the online news rag.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, unfortunately. Now, occasionally they have some interesting stuff, but here's how their headline reads. NASA's Curiosity rover spots pyramid on Mars. And I say pyramid that way because it's in all caps. And then the second part of that headline is it proof of an ancient civilization? That ancient civilization notion idea, that's ridiculous, obviously. And frankly, it's just eye candy just to make you click on the headline in case the pyramid didn't get you in at first.
But Evan, the Daily Mail also repeats the story, so there you go.
Well, you know, that's what they do. Yes, in fact, Curiosity rover has taken many, 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 many photos on the Martian surface and all sorts of things it has revealed. In this particular picture, have you guys seen the picture? There is some sort of pyramid-ish looking either protrusion coming up from out of the sand or something that, you know, is sitting on top of the sandy surface. You know, we've heard about all sorts of crazy stuff on Mars before. We've seen images that appear to be, for example, an iguana, or a forest of trees.
Or Bigfoot.
And Bigfoot, in fact. Yes. And so... Just, you know, those are zany and impossible as far as I'm concerned. But something that looks like a pyramid on Mars, I think is one of the least zany and perhaps impossible things, that I can think of that has ever been suggested is on the Martian surface. According to the article itself, they pretty much concentrated on what the conspiracy theory crowd sort of had to say about this. They kind of went right to that source. And they got lots of funny, interesting quotes. You know, here's one that says, it is the result of intelligent design and certainly not a trick of light and shadow.
Really? And, that's awesome.
Among many, many other comments.
And science will never disprove this comment.
How about we talk about some things that are much more plausible, such as, for example, a rock or a large boulder, or like I said, some protrusion of rock substance coming up from under the sand.
Because if you look at the big photo, the photo of the surrounding scene, it's clearly just a freaking rock. It's on like the side of a hill. It's not like even flat. You know what I mean? The ground is sloped and there's all kinds of a jumble of rocks there. This is just one that happened to be caught at an angle where it is a trick of the light. It's exactly what it is.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you're right, Steve.
It's just a rock, clearly.
But why should that interfere with a perfectly good headline that reads, Proof of Ancient Civilization?
When I looked at it, I didn't look at the big picture. I looked at the smaller picture. And my first
you
reaction.
You never look at the big picture, Bob.
Yeah, right. my reaction was that it was fake, that it was photoshopped, that it looked too much like they took a pyramid and just threw it in there. I'll take a look at the big picture, but that was my take on the small picture.
If you zoom in on the tiny picture and you don't really have a sense of scale, you think it's like a structure, you could think, oh, that's actually somewhat impressive. But when you see the big picture, it's clearly just a freaking rock.
And it's not like pyramid-shaped rocks don't exist naturally.
It's not the whole thing. It's just a corner of a rock that's sticking out of the ground. You know what I mean?
We have this one picture from this one angle. You can't judge anything by that.
There are so many possibilities of how it could be, assuming it was the shape that it is, there are so many possibilities of how that could happen. It could simply be that a piece of another rock has been cleaved off, and that's what's left.
If you look at the other rocks in the photograph, there's a lot of flat surfaces. There's even another rock that looks sort of like a pyramid, except the top is broken off a little bit. This is the type of flat surfaces whatever this mineral is forming. The other thing is, this is totally the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, right? Mm-hmm. It's like you're looking at, you know, there's hundreds of rocks in this one photo. You're looking at thousands of photographs. The possibilities are endless. And then anything that looks interesting, that's your bullseye. It's not like they went looking specifically for pyramids. They went looking for anything interesting. And so they completely underestimate the probability that given enough chances, you're going to find something that meets the vague criteria of interesting. And that's all that this is.
And guess what? You don't even have to go to Mars to do this. You can just look around your own planet and find these exact sort of similar shapes and rocks that look like pyramids and are pointy.
Yeah.
Ancient civilizations need not apply. So that one's done. Moving on to Ceres. Yes. Very large asteroid. Dwarf planet? No? Yes?
Yes. It's a dwarf planet.
Yeah. Used to be thought to be a planet, actually, but
it was not a planet briefly. It's still an asteroid. It's still the largest asteroid, but it's also a dwarf planet.
Now, Steve, you mentioned the Daily Mail earlier.
Yeah.
Here's how their headline reads. Pyramid, which are in quotes, spotted on Ceres. Mysterious lone mountain discovered towering over the surface of the dwarf planet. And reading this article, I thought it was an interesting contrast to what was happening over at the Mirror. They actually did not consult the conspiracy theorists for their opinion as to what was going on. No, they actually spoke with some scientists. So this is a much better article, as it turns out. What's happening is that as the Dawn probe or Dawn spacecraft approaches Ceres and is bound to get closer and closer, as the upcoming months go by, it's taking more and more photographs. And of course, this is the one where they have the shot of Ceres, and you can kind of see along the horizon, there's this protrusion. It's a mountain, in fact. And they estimate it to be 5 kilometers tall. That's a big mountain. The reason it's special is because there are no other mountains around it. In fact, it's on quite what would be considered a relatively flat part of the dwarf planet. So, that's interesting. What is it doing there, and how did it get there, and why the lonely mountain, and why not a mountain range? And we don't know. Hopefully as Dawn gets closer and takes more high resolution photographs, we'll learn some more about it. But there are lots of reasons why mountains or even lone mountains can possibly appear on a planet or an asteroid.
Yeah, but that's a genuine mystery, because it doesn't really fit the usual explanations. Like, it's not in the middle of a crater. There's none of the uplifting that would explain like a part of a mountain range. So yeah, right at the moment, from what I've read, astronomers really don't know how to explain it. Doesn't mean it's magic, you know, or intelligent aliens or whatever. It just means that, oh, that's a curious geological feature that it's not immediately obvious how to explain how it arose. That's a genuine mystery. Much like the bright spot on Ceres. I can't wait to figure out what the hell that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. They took some new images of the bright spot, and it's actually a series of spots.
Yeah.
Not just one, it's several. And again, as we get closer, as dawn gets closer, by the, it's right now at about 4,400 kilometers above the surface. But come December of this year, it will be a mere, say, 250 kilometers above the surface. So we're going to get some much better photographs and be able to really get a better handle on what the mountain's all about, what the bright lights are about. And who knows what else will turn up. But like you said, Steve, these are the cool mysteries of science that, you know, keep scientists sort of on the edge of their seats and guessing and speculating on lots of different things. This is good stuff.
I think it's just a reflective, probably metal or something that was exposed.
Or ice or something.
Or salt. I think salt was salt. An option.
Could be salt.
Mm-hmm. There's now CNN covers this story. They have a picture of the bright spot on Ceres. And next to that, a picture of Las Vegas from space at night, and it looks the same.
You mean like if you were to superimpose one over the other?
Therefore, not kind of the they same? Look this not the same in shape. They look the same in just it looks like a bright blob. Therefore, it must be a city
or a series of casinos.
CNN did that.
Yeah, I have to say, Ceres is turning out to be more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Oh yeah,
a couple of genuine mysteries because you know you figured an asteroid, it's just a big rock. You know, we're going to see it's a cratered little planetoid. But no, there's some cool stuff there. We have a couple of dumbest things of the week this week. Very quickly, the first one, which was my first pick for it, but then it got supplanted by another one, but I'm still going to mention it. So Eddie Van Halen, you guys are big Eddie Van Halen fans, right?
Oh yeah.
One of the best, best rock guitarists. And
sure.
He, a few years ago, developed tongue cancer, which apparently he's doing well, recovering from it. But, what came out recently is during an interview, he said, now, even though he was a smoker for many years, he blamed his tongue cancer on putting metal guitar picks in his mouth in the studio and the electromagnetic waves sort of getting into his mouth the brass or copper guitar picks.
Oh.
Oh, dear. Uh-huh.
Well, if it was a lead pick, then maybe he may have some sort of point, but no, not
a pick that was in asbestos dipped in cancer or something.
Dipped in cancer.
Or if it was like asbestos. So just interesting. You know, maybe there's a little bit of denial in there, assumption of cause and effect. You know, but why did people go for the interesting and the obscure rather than, you smoked for decades?
Well, Eddie Van Halen's got a bit of a history, though, with a bit of, flawed thinking. He went on some kind of fad diet a couple of years ago and ended up with a perforated bowel as a result. Oops. So,
really?
He's got a little bit of a history of going
Not
down a bit
thinking
of a kooky
critically.
Path. But I did get to see him play recently, and it was damn good. So.
He's an amazing guitarist.
Seen Van Halen several times. They're awesome. Yeah, Eddie Van Halen is a kook. and you know, if you read any of Sammy Hagar's stories or whatever, you know, he and his brother, the drummer in the band, like they chain smoke.
Yeah.
The entire day, every day. Like, that's it. And, like, you know, for him to think, you know, it had nothing to do with the thing that I do that causes cancer and mouth cancer.
Yeah.
You know, for him to like, have to come up with some other thing is so ridiculous, it blows my mind.
Hence the dumbest thing of the week. But I saw something today I had to include because it's just so outrageous. You know that, unfortunately, we had another mass murder in this country, Dylann Roof. Decided to go into a black church in South Carolina, hang out for an hour, and then shoot up the place. And he killed 9 people, I believe, correct? Horrible. Yep. Just a horrible. And the kid is, you know, according to his own writing, his own manifesto, he is a horrible racist and white supremacist. And he felt he needed to kill black people because they're ruining the world. You know, that sort of thing. I mean, just real hardcore KKK style racist.
Pure hate.
So some commentators on the right are doing some mental gymnastics to try to correlate his behavior with anything else that they can come up with. One of the worst, this is just absolutely despicable. This comes from Evolution News and Views from the Disco 2, right? The Discovery Institute, the cesspit of intelligent design. This is a writer, David Klinghoffer, who somehow managed to make a connection between Dylann Roof's massacre and evolution. So
what?
Yeah. Wow. It's just totally ridiculous. Get this. So apparently the white supremacist who was in Dylann Roof's group, or who was the head of his group, also heads another group. And this other group, which Roof was not a part of, as part of their rhetoric, they justify their racism with bad evolutionary arguments. White people are evolutionarily superior to black people, basically.
Right.
So that's it. So apparently this kid's head was full of evolutionary thinking when he shot up that church in South Carolina.
Of course, because we all know evolution is the root of all evil thoughts.
It's just...
it all starts there.
Ridiculous. And of course, he's still trying to tie evolution to like Hitler and eugenics and all that stuff. And racism as if somehow it's the result of evolution, which is historically nonsense. There were plenty of biblical justifications for racism, and you know, a lot of the KKK and racist people use the Bible to justify their racism. And eugenics was based more on breeding than evolutionary theory. And in any case, it doesn't matter if somebody abuses a scientific theory for a stupid reason. It says nothing about the validity of that scientific theory. It's all just ridiculous nonsense. But the blatant intellectual dishonesty, it's really disgusting. And it's totally on display at the Discovery Institute. They have much closer ties to racism than anything that evolution does. And of course, it's irrelevant. It doesn't say anything about the scientific evidence, but it just shows that they are engaged not in science, but in a hit job on evolution, because that's their job, is to,
sure.
Yeah, to oppose evolution because it conflicts with their religious beliefs. That's what they're doing.
Yep. They'll say anything.
Apparently anything. They will. We have one question this week. This comes from Dominic, and Dominic writes, I really enjoy listening to your show, and especially guidelines on how to discuss skeptical topics with family and friends. It's often very hard when you have a wife who is a fan of homeopathy, very common in France, a sister-in-law who is against GMOs, a best friend who is really into astrology. I have taken to heart your advice to not just laugh at their beliefs, but instead engage in a discussion, even though we come back to the usual debate points. I was wondering if I should not start by discussing some baby steps in critical thinking, such as confirmation bias, the importance of double-blinded trials, looking at more than one experiment, fishing for positives. What would you say, here comes the question, you ready? What would you say are the top 4 to 5 conversations to have that would pave the way for a better critical discussion later on? Thanks and keep up the good work. All right, so we each get one. So everyone pick, if you could teach Dominic one, or you know, tell Dominic one critical thinking lesson to try to implant in his family members to lay the groundwork and plant those seeds of critical thinking that he could then bear fruit later on, what would you pick?
We have to talk about like how to begin this process of trying to help someone. And I think the first step is find common ground. Find something that you could talk to each of them about as an individual that they don't have any value to. So as an example, like the brother-in-law, he said, or the friend that believes in astrology might actually think that homeopathy is BS or not even care about homeopathy. So talk to him about homeopathy first and get a common ground. So you could start teaching scientific principles with something that he doesn't care about or something that is an interesting discussion that you could then take, you know, elevate his thinking, elevate his processing and his logic in that area.
Yeah, I agree. Find something that he really doesn't believe in, that they are very skeptical of, and then spend time exploring that skepticism. And you could say things like, well, all right, you don't believe in Bigfoot. You think Bigfoot is BS. Okay, well, how do you explain people who see Bigfoot? And then that opens the doorway to all how unreliable firsthand accounts are, eyewitnesses, faulty memories, faulty perceptions. All of that, you know, poor scientific rigor, you could bring a lot of things into that discussion and they'll agree with you, and you can educate them about a lot of critical thinking principles on a topic that on which you have common ground. I totally agree with that.
I think that's somewhat similar to what I find quite useful. And I tend to think that we assume a basic level of knowledge that isn't remotely close to what the average person actually understands about science. So I think sometimes you can find yourself going into those discussions about you know, randomized controlled trials and logical fallacies and so on. But, you know, even when we talk about things like evidence, those very, very basic terms that you might be familiar with as a sort of hardened skeptic are things that the layperson out there really sees from a completely different standpoint than what you do. So I avoid going straight into trying to teach them any of those techniques or about logical fallacies. And I actually, first I try to, I think it's important to try and actually empathize with the person and have more of that putting yourself on the same level as them, and perhaps using an experience that you've had where your own thinking has been flawed as a way to demonstrate to them how you have actually gotten to a process of seeing something differently. So, you know, it could be something like, I mean, okay, I suppose it's kind of a big one that I wouldn't necessarily use for say something like homeopathy or astrology, but, you know, I can think about the fact that I used to think that climate change wasn't real, and I've kind of, through a process of thinking about that and seeing things differently, I've changed my mind. So I often find it's useful to sort of just try and introduce them to the process you went through to change your mind about something or to see something differently, but without necessarily drawing them straight into the complicated issues around the scientific process that a lot of people do struggle with.
Bob, I know what you're going to say.
Yes, if you probably are. For me, I think it's absolutely key to understand the real nature of human memory and perception. You know, memories aren't recordings. Like we were talking with that Pixar movie, you know, they're not little videotapes in your mind that are just absolute and pure. And the idea that's really important, I think, is that the reality that we think is real, absolutely real, it's an active construction.
Yeah.
It's not a passive recording. It's an active process that changes with time. So I think once you have that understanding of how fallible we really can be, for lots of important details, I think that is a very good initial point to start for breaking down, you know, your sacred cows.
I agree. People, if they really embrace an understanding of the constructed nature of perception and memory, that, you know, our concept of reality, that would go a long way, I think, to diffusing a lot of belief. What do you got, Evan?
Carl Sagan once said so perfectly, science delivers the goods.
Yeah.
So understanding that the core of science is in fact the scientific method, you can then accept that for what it is, because we have all these incredible things. I mean, down to the medicines we take, and that is applicable to everything. You can really, and that's how we know what works and what doesn't work. And how we know what is real and what is not, turns out not to be real.
I agree with that, Evan, but that's probably the most challenging one, because the problem with that is that you basically have to teach people science. And there's a lot that goes into that, because the, you know, 90% of the way along that process of understanding how science works, they're still going to be vulnerable to pseudoscience, right? They're going to believe in homeopathy and think homeopathy is scientific until they get to a very sophisticated level of understanding science. What the research shows is that you basically need to get to a postgraduate level of understanding science before your belief in pseudoscience really starts to diminish.
But I'm not even talking about explaining to them biology or chemistry or any of the, you know, of the sciences that we learn in the classrooms. I'm just trying to take some practical everyday things and make a lesson.
I understand that, but I'm saying that's a good thing to do, but that's the hardest. You may need to focus on the specific area that you're interested in. Like if they're interested in homeopathy, you may need to lay the groundwork about what clinical trials are and the placebo effect. And you might need to, you know, put a few pieces of specific scientific knowledge together and then try to bring it all together around homeopathy. Or either that, or you just need to go for an appreciation for how to understand what the scientific consensus is. And then say, okay, let's find out now what the scientific consensus is on homeopathy. You know what I'm saying? So that might be a good approach as well, but just a blanket appreciation for science and the scientific method unfortunately isn't enough. It actually makes people believe more in pseudoscience because it opens.
Especially because if you look at, for example, you know, a lot of the courses out there in those pseudosciences, they teach them alongside a degree of science. So, you know, you might do a course in homeopathy and you'll also do some biology. You'll do some anatomy and physiology and you'll do courses which really do encompass some science, but it's distorted and it's taught alongside the rest of it. And they're unable to actually tease out what's scientific and what isn't.
That's pseudoscience. What you're saying, Evan, would be better for attacking anti-science. But the examples that Dominic gave, homeopathy, anti-GMO, and astrology are pseudosciences. They're not anti-science. And so people say, well, astrology is scientific. It follows a scientific method. They have charts and information and all whatever, blah, blah, blah. You take somebody who's basically scientifically illiterate and make them scientifically literate. That takes years. But if you had one specific thing that you could focus on, like GMOs, that's, you can do a deep dive on that one topic. It'll still take you a long time. And you still got lay a lot of groundwork. But, so anyway, I hear what you're saying. It's just, I think that's a tricky one because it's so deep. For mine, I mean, you guys mentioned all good ones. You covered a lot of the things I would have said. I will add to that, I think, an appreciation for narrative. And what I mean by that is that you could also call it ideology, but just the idea that we come up with a belief and then that belief colors everything that we think. The narrative comes first and then we backfill facts and arguments. That's called motivated reasoning, right? So if you're starting from an ideology, whether it's a political ideology, a social ideology, a religious ideology, whatever, we are really good, really good at backfilling the justification for that belief, at allowing the narrative to come first and then the facts and reasons to come later. You have to get people to flip that, to really step away from their ideology, to step away from their preferred narrative, to look at facts and evidence first. If you can get somebody to appreciate how that works, I think that's a good hook. That's good skeptical hook to have in somebody. And it could be on anything. You know, just pick one topic. Let's say they have political ideas about gun control and then get them to lay out why they believe what they believe and say, okay, let's do a different process now. Let's pretend like we have no beliefs about this whatsoever. Let's agree ahead of time how we're going to look for the facts, you know, what kind of facts are going to be important, what kind of evidence, and then we'll see what it says. We'll see what it says together. And if that dramatically contradicts their a priori ideology, yeah, they may walk away from that with a good skeptical lesson. Then the trick is, of course, applying all of these things to their own beliefs. That's always the hard part, right? All right. Thank you, Dominic. Well, guys, it is time for science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Except this week, Evan is at the helm. Evan.
I am.
You're running science or fiction.
I have the wheel. I have the...
Oh, you mean I'm up against Steve?
No, you're up against yourself. You're up against yourself.
Fear not. I have a feeling that this week's science or fiction will be, in a way, a great equalizer of all things, because we have a couple special things. We have a theme this week. and we have four items, not just three.
Double.
So, the theme this week is effects. Effects. I'm going to describe to you four
effects or effects.
Effects.
Okay, gotcha.
I'm going to describe to you four effects that are, well, three of them are actual effects, but one of them is fiction. Are you ready? All right. Number one.
Don't know.
This is called the Brown Willie effect. It is an optical phenomenon visible during a transit of Venus or Mercury in which something resembling a drop of water appears to connect the disk of the planet with the edge of the sun. And it's named for the discoverers of the effect. Brown Willie. All right. Number two is called the Jack-in-the-Box effect. This is a catastrophic kill on a tank or other turreted armored vehicle in which an ammunition explosion causes the tank's turret to be violently blown off the chassis and up into the air. Jack in the Box, the name, it comes after the child, comes from the child's toy, which is the Jack in the Box, and in which you crank the box and a puppet pops up. Number three is called the overview effect. And this is a cognitive shift in awareness reported by some astronauts and cosmonauts during spaceflight, often while viewing the Earth either from orbit or from the lunar surface. And the fourth one is called the Woozle effect. And this occurs when frequent citation of previous publications that lack evidence misleads people into believing that there is evidence. Urban legends are an example of the Woozle effect. I have, before we started the show, I determined the order in which we're going to go. I rolled a D4. I designated each one of you one of the numbers. And guess who came up first? Jay Novella.
Okay. The Brown Willie effect. I don't know why.
Right, that. Jay? Brown Willie.
I know. It's just, come on. Yeah. So this is when two bodies come close to each other and they look like they're touching each other before they get there.
It happens during the transit of either Venus or Mercury. So that's when, from the Earth, you see the planet cross the disk of the sun.
All right. Sure. Then we got the Jack in the Box effect. I used to eat at Jack in the Box when I was a kid. And there is a different Jack in the Box effect that I could describe here, but I won't.
Awesome.
The catastrophic kill of a tank. Now, this one is awesome. Yeah, I know that something like this exists. I just don't know if this is the name, and therefore that's what Evan is quizzing us on.
Evan, can I clarify with that? So Is it possible for the fiction to be a fiction because the name is wrong, even if the effect is real?
Correct. That is correct.
Okay, so all of these are real effects, just one of the names is fake.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, okay. That's a good clarification. Thank you, Steve. The jack-in-the-box effect does seem to match this effect because there's a guy in a box. So this is fine. I'm going to say that one. I'll agree with that one. The overview effect, again, I was thinking about this when Evan was reading it. This is the shift in awareness reported by some astronauts. Yeah, I've read something about this. I don't know what the name was. I don't remember, but I do remember reading something about this because I'm so into space travel. And the overview effect sounds, you know, like a very good descriptor of what's going on. So I will put that one in the correct bin. The Woozle effect. Jesus, Em. You know, bamboozle, woozle, fafoozle, moozle. I like the word. It kind of goes with this. I guess I'm not liking the Brown Willie effect because it just sounds ridiculous. Like, it sounds like something that everyone would make up. A Brown Willie, get away from me with that wet finger. Go ahead. Next.
Okay, Jay. Next on the list is special guest Joe.
All right. I'll start from the first one. So I don't know. The Brown Willie effect kind of works for me because I don't know whether it's in Australia. We just have really weird names for things. There's a sort of like a tornado, like when you get a little, one of those sort of little tornadoes where you see a plastic bag floating around. It's called a Willy Willy. So I don't know why that one kind of works for me, but it doesn't seem to quite work with what it's describing. The Jack in the Box effect makes sense. I can kind of, yeah, that seems to fit with it. The overview effect seems, it's actually one that, I mean, yeah, something about that one's just not sitting right with me, but the Woozle effect, I think, makes sense to me in terms of the name as well. I'm kind of tossing up between the Woozle effect and the overview effect though, and I think I'm going to go with the overview effect as being the fiction.
Okay. Next up is Bob.
Well, yeah, I'm familiar with pretty much all of these effects, not the names, of course, actually. Well, pretty much none of the names, but they all kind of make sense to me in terms of the name of the phenomenon. But the only one that seems to be an outlier is Woozle. It doesn't really fit. I don't know where Woozle would come from except bamboozle or something like that. But Woozle, I'd never even heard that word before. The other ones make sense. Overview, Jack in the Box, even the Brown Willie, that's named after two people. So that's fine. Although clearly Brown Willie has, weird connotations to it. And that's fine, and maybe that's why he picked it. I'm gonna say the Woozle effect is fiction.
And finally, Stephen.
I agree with Bob that Jack in the Box and the overview effect makes sense. I have no problem with those terms. If it's Jack in the Box, Evan, then congratulations, because that it is perfect. But I'll accept that one. Yeah, the Brown Willie, I mean, two people's names. I mean, it sounds funny because of the Wet Willie, you know, so Free Willie. Just there's something about it. The second name being Willie, certainly. But it's, you know, I've heard plenty of other, you know, two people being cited as credit for something, and it kind of sounds weird. You know, that's medicine is loaded with those. So that doesn't sound abnormal to me, but it certainly is something that Evan could have made up. The Woozle effect, you know, I have a big problem with, but you could go either way, because I could think to myself that it's so crazy Evan had to make it up. I could also think it's so crazy Evan never would have made it up. You know, like if he was good at would he have given us a softball like the Woozle effect as the fiction?
Yeah.
So that's why I can go either way with that one. Like if I don't choose it as the fiction, I'll feel like an idiot if it's the fiction. It's like, come on, guys, the Woozle effect, you know?
But, Woozle.
Yeah, so, God, I'm stuck. But I think, I guess I'll choose the Brown Willie effect as the fiction.
All right, then I'm going to review this just to make sure I've got your answers correctly. For the Brown Willie effect, both Jay and Steve say that that one is fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Joe, you said the overview effect for you is fiction. And Bob, the Woozle effect for you, that one is fiction.
Yes.
Am I correct, Bob? Yes, quite.
Which means we're going to start with the Jack in the Box effect. And I'll read it again. It's a catastrophic kill on a tank or other turreted armor vehicle in which an ammunition explosion causes the tank's turret to be violently blown off the chassis and into the air, named after the child's toy, the Jack in the Box, in which a puppet pops up. And that one is...
Is it a sweep? Is it a sweep?
Science.
Science.
No sweep,
baby.
Science. So, nope, no sweep.
It also sounds like the kind of thing a World War II, you know, people would have. Right? That's like very, very
cheesy.
Yes,
World War II. Yeah. Perfect, Steve. Yep. That's exactly correct, in fact. Tanks of the World War II era were frequently seen to have lost their turrets in this manner, in which they had the ammunition stored, but the compartment was buttoned up. There was nowhere for the pressure if the tank took a hit to release. So guess what? The ammunition took it the whole thing off.
Yeah.
And they do have some evidence and photographs, obviously, and some video of these things blowing up like a Jack in the Box. And they did dub it the Jack in the Box effect. For modern tanks, that doesn't happen anymore.
Oh, really?
The ammunition compartments are designed for to fail safely under fire in a firefight. If they're damaged, there are vents that open and they prevent this from happening. So World War II, yes, but not in modern times. Okay. So that was a good pickup, Steve. I'm going to start with the Woozle effect. Bob, you said that this one was the fiction. And the Woozle effect is, in fact, science.
Crap!
Oh, yes.
There is a Woozle effect. The term Woozle effect was coined by Beverly Houghton in 1979. Now, a Woozle is an imaginary character in the book Winnie the Pooh, which was first published in 1926. In Chapter 3... in which Pooh and Piglet go hunting and nearly catch a Woozle.
Of course! Oh my, I knew that word was familiar.
There you go. So what they do is the characters Pooh and Piglet start following the tracks that they are left in the snow, believing they're following the tracks of the Woozle, but the tracks keep multiplying, and Christopher Robin then explains they've been following their own tracks and going around in a circle.
Now, if they had called it the Heffalump effect, or the Snuffleupagus effect.
That would have been
that would have been
less obscure than the Woozle effect.
Again, this one reads, the Woozle effect occurs when frequent citation of previous publications that lack evidence mislead people into believing that there is evidence. And yes, in fact, like I said, Beverly Houghton was the one to coin this term. She was a researcher who studied basically patterns of self-bias seen within the social sciences. This effect occurs when frequent citation of previous publications that lack evidence mislead individuals, as we said. Also affects groups and the public into thinking or believing that there is evidence and facts having to do with either social sciences or government or policy making and these sorts of things. And, of course, urban myths and urban legends also arise out of this effect.
And we talked a few weeks ago, I think, on the show about citation bias, literally citation bias, about citing studies that support your premise and under citing studies which contradict it.
Right.
Creating a woozle effect.
Woozle effect. We will not soon forget that one. So we're down to two. We have the overview effect and the Brown-Woolley effect going in reverse order still. The overview effect is a cognitive shift in awareness reported by some astronauts and cosmonauts during spaceflight, often while viewing the Earth either from orbit or the lunar surface. Joe, you felt that this one was the fiction, and this one is
da-da-da-da.
Science. It is.
It just seemed like, you know, all of the effects have got really, really daft names. It was just too simple.
Yeah, it's a very profound experience, and especially the isolation aspect of it, too. I think it adds to it.
Rusty Schweikert, in 1969, did a spacewalk, and here's what he had to say about it. He said, when you go around the Earth in an hour and a half, you begin to recognize that your identity is with that whole thing. That makes a change. It comes through to you so powerfully that you're the sensing element for man. And he felt a euphoric sensation through all of it. Also a bit of space sickness, but.
Space sickness.
Right, exactly. Which means the Brown-Woolley effect, an optical phenomenon visible during the transit of Venus or Mercury, in which something resembling a drop of water appears to connect the disk of the planet with the edge of the sun, is fiction. That is an actual effect. It is not called the Brown-Woolley effect. It is, in fact, called the black drop effect. Actually, I didn't make up Brown-Woolley. The Brown-Woolley effect is an actual...
What?
Yes, the Brown-Woolley effect, a meteorological phenomenon that sometimes occurs across the southwest peninsula of Britain. It leads to heavy showers developing over the high grounds of Bodmin Moor in Cornwall, England, which then often travels a considerable distance downwind of their place of origin. It's named after the hill Brown-Woolley, the highest point on the moor and in Cornwall as a whole. And it's thought that there was a flood in 2004 that was caused by this particular effect. And the pictures of it is just devastating. I mean, you know, it looks like basically landslides and mudslides all over the place, taking out cars, houses, people, and all sorts of stuff. So the Brown-Woolley is a real effect. So glad you all enjoyed it. We spread out the answers a bit. Congratulations to Jay and Steve.
Of course.
Bob and Joe, better luck next time. Yes. Thanks for playing.
Evan, hit us with the quote of the week.
This week's quote is as follows. The problem with today's world is that everyone believes they have the right to express their opinion and have others listen to it. The correct statement of individual rights is that everyone has the right to an opinion, but crucially, that opinion can be roundly ignored and even made fun of, particularly if it is demonstrably nonsense. None other than Brian Cox, scientist, astrophysicist, popularizer of science, wonderful television show host, all-around great guy. And very well said. We talk about this a lot in skepticism.
Absolutely. And in fact, it actually Evan, I interrupted, but it actually brings it around nicely to where we started the show because, there was a Patrick Stokes, who is a doctor of philosophy, from Australia, who's involved with Stop the AVN, wrote an article on the conversation called No, You're Not Entitled to Your Opinion, which has been one of the most widely read, on that exact topic. So it's a really nice little summary of it.
Sure. And we've also talked recently about this notion of a false balance of having to report both sides of the issues. And, you know, no, that's not the case, especially when one side is absolute nonsense and has absolutely no place being next to or compared to anything having to do with actual science.
Joe, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Steve. It's been great. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Thanks, Dr. Steve.
Thanks, Dr. Shirley.
Thanks, Steve.
We love you, Joe.
Oh, I love you guys, too.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.
Bye.